Good evening. 56 years ago today, one of the most traumatic events in American history occurred.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
And an hour later came confirmation of the worst.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
And nurses demand protection as schools demand money. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, November 22, 2019. It was a routine visit to Dallas, a great American city, by well-liked leader, except for a small but vocal group of fringe right-wingers. Then at least three shots rang out, apparently from the sixth floor of a building called the Texas School Depository. According to the official story told in dozens of volumes the next year by a commission headed by Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, a disgruntled former communist working in the building named Lee Harvey Oswald used a cheap Italian-made rifle to squeeze off the shots. The first bullet was never found. Another passed through Kennedy's neck, exiting and struck Texas Governor John Connally, who recovered from his wounds. Another bullet then struck the president, blowing his head apart and spattering First Lady Jackie Kennedy with the fragments. In a panic, the First Lady clambered on the back of the open-top limousine, some say to retrieve the top of her husband's skull. Rushing to nearby Parkland Memorial Hospital, President Kennedy died. Here's the report from CBS TV Archives, as explained by CBS News.
The next 30 minutes, As the World Turns.
For viewers of the CBS soap opera, As the World Turns, first word came at about 1:40 p.m. Eastern Time. It happened too quickly for cameras to be in place.
And I gave it a great deal of thought, Grandpa.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Then it was back to the soap opera, but not for long. Soon after, Walter Cronkite was back, reporting from the CBS newsroom, complete with rotary telephones and wire machines.
This picture has just been transmitted by wire. It is a picture taken just a moment or two before the incident. If you can zoom in with that camera, we can get a closer look at this picture.
And almost exactly 1 hour after his initial bulletin, this now famous announcement.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
Police closed in on Oswald while he was watching a film near the site where a Dallas police officer had been shot to death. Oswald was brought to a Dallas police station where he said he was being blamed for something he didn't do.
I'd like some legal representation. These police officers have not allowed me to have any. I don't know what this is all about.
To kill the president?
No, sir, I didn't. People keep asking me that. Sir?
Did you get the president?
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
Did you shoot the president?
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in the Soviet Union. I'm just a patsy.
Did you shoot the president?
And in the same police station, 2 days almost to the hour after JFK died, Lee Harvey Oswald was shot and killed in police custody by nightclub owner Jack Ruby.
Chief, do you have any concern for the safety of your prisoner in view of the high feeling among the people of Dallas over the assassination of the president?
No, but precautions necessary. Precautions will be taken, of course.
He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot.
Oswald expired at 1:07 p.m.
Scott. He died.
Vice President Lyndon Baines Johnson took the oath of office on Air Force One, standing next to Jackie Kennedy.
At 2:38 in the forward cabin of Air Force One, a necessary ceremony.
I solemnly swear.
William Pepper is an assassination researcher who has worked for the family of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He says the three major American assassinations of the 60s, not including Malcolm X, JFK, Martin Luther King, and the president's brother Robert Kennedy, are linked by their own patsy, someone who was blamed but who couldn't have committed the murder.
I think it stresses to believe that all of those assassinations in the 60s, particularly the one starting with Jack Kennedy, were mounted by individuals who did not have an axe to grind and instructions from enemies of the state, really.
None of the investigations, particularly in the JFK case, the Warren Commission investigation, gave us an accurate picture despite its dozens and dozens of volumes?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that an accurate picture has really emerged, certainly not into the mainstream media. And that's not to disparage the very good work that a number of researchers have done over the years. But Jack Kennedy was the first most inconvenient of the presidents who had to be eliminated. He was, if anything, going to perpetuate the New Deal values of Franklin Roosevelt, which had been interrupted by Harry Truman.
What do you think really happened? If it wasn't three bullets fired by Lee Harvey Oswald on the sixth floor of a book depository, what do you think happened?
He was assassinated by pros, and I think the critical, what I know is pretty much what most people, I think, have available to them at this point, is that he was hit from the front, that there were shots fired from the grassy knoll, and the one that killed him, that took out his brain, really, was the critical shot. That they didn't come from behind or the side where Lee Harvey Oswald was, but that they came from the front.
And do you think that Lee Harvey Oswald was right when he said, "I'm a patsy"?
Oh, I don't think there's any question of that. I think Oswald was a patsy, just as James Earl Ray was a patsy for the killing of Martin King, and Sirhan was a patsy for the killing of Bob Kennedy.
What is the lesson, just to wrap up, what's the lesson that people can take away from the Kennedy assassination and the following assassinations that would be applicable today?
I think, Paul, people should be critical. They should be skeptical of what the official story is. They should be mindful of what Carl Bernstein tried to teach us back in the late 70s, that the largest publisher in the world is the Central Intelligence Agency. And that, for example, Sulzberger of the New York Times gave Alan Dulles 12 slots in the Times in 1959. So that leads you to the conclusion that on matters of high, important national security, people should really be skeptical and just look beyond the pale.
What does that mean for radio stations and independent news outlets like WBAI?
I think BAI and independent news stations like BAI obviously fill a need that is simply not there by the mainstream. Even progressive stations and progressive programs just draw the line when it comes to getting at the truth of these morbid events.
William Pepper is an assassination researcher who has worked for the family of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. 56 years ago today, I was in Miss Lane's second grade class at St. Paul the Apostle School in Yonkers, New York, when the class was herded into the adjoining church to pray for the president. When I got home after school, my mom was in hysterics, and while I was watching TV at the tender age of 7, I saw Lee Harvey Oswald get shot live in the gut. When they buried JFK, my mom cried as little John, my age, saluted the casket. She said, "Why can't you be more like him?" I'm Paul DiRienzo. In impeachment news, the fallout from yesterday's impeachment hearings hit the morning talk shows on Friday. We have this report.
I'm Jesse Lent with WBAI's Impeachment Watch. On Friday morning, the day after public impeachment hearings by the House Intelligence Committee ended, President Donald Trump called up his favorite morning show, Fox and Friends. For nearly an hour, the president presented an alternate narrative to the one offered in the testimony of 12 government officials over 5 days of public hearings. He also had some strong words for House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, who's overseen the impeachment proceedings so far, and Speaker Nancy Pelosi, whose decision it was to begin impeachment proceedings in the House.
I've been tougher on Russia than any president in history, but for 2.5 years I've had to listen. This was their talking point, Trump and Russia. And if you take a look at it, just look at the facts. Even look at what I've done for Ukraine by giving them tank busters, by giving them stuff. And Obama would send pillows and sheets. He wouldn't send anything else. The whole thing. Now, Schiff, remember this. He makes it all up. He's sick. There's something wrong with him. So he made up my phone call. He made it up. He made up a phone call. And then when I released it, everybody was embarrassed. And crazy Nancy Pelosi, who, by the way, is going to go down as the worst speaker in the history of the House of Representatives. She hasn't done anything. All she said, she's like paralyzed. She cannot do anything.
In his closing statement on Thursday that ended the public hearings, Chairman Schiff had some words of his own about the president's alleged conduct while in office.
The day after Bob Mueller testified, that Donald Trump invited Russian interference, hey, Russia, if you're listening, come get Hillary's emails, and later that day, they tried to hack her server. The day after he testified that not only did Trump invite that interference, but that he welcomed the help in the campaign. They made full use of it. They lied about it. They obstructed the investigation into it. And all this is in his testimony and his report. The day after that, Donald Trump is back on the phone asking another nation to involve itself in another U.S. election. That says to me, this president believes he is above the law, beyond accountability. And in my view, there is nothing more dangerous than an unethical president who believes they are above the law. And I would just say to people watching here at home and around the world, in the words of my great colleague, we are better than that. Adjourned.
Chairman Schiff's final line is a reference to the late Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings, who died last month at the age of 68, and who had, up until then, been a leading figure in the Trump impeachment inquiry in his role as chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. Now that the public impeachment hearings have concluded, unless a new potential witness comes forward to testify, like former National Security Advisor John Bolton, or any of a number of high-profile Trump administration officials who have obeyed the president's order not to appear despite receiving a congressional subpoena, the next step in the impeachment process will be for Chairman Schiff to submit a report to the House Judiciary Committee, the body that decides whether to draft articles of impeachment against the president. For the WBAI Evening News, this has been Impeachment Watch. I'm Jesse Lent.
Thanks, Jesse. On Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill to protect health care and social service workers from workplace violence. H.R. 1309, the Workplace Violence Prevention for Health Care and Social Service Workers Act, was authored by Representative Joe Courtney of Connecticut. In a rarity for this Congress, the bill passed with strong bipartisan support. Nurses say there's an epidemic of violence in hospitals because there are few programs to address the problem. Amira Sakara is lead legislative advocate for National Nurses United.
Every day across this country, nurses are at risk of violence in their hospitals, and other healthcare workers and other social service workers are at risk of violence in their workplaces. Violence on the job has become an epidemic for registered nurses and other workers in healthcare and social service settings. Our nurse members across the country, we represent 155,000 unionized registered nurses across the country, and our members are consistently reporting being punched, being kicked, being bitten, being strangled, sometimes being beaten very severely. We have unfortunately over the years had a few members who have been killed at their workplaces. And for years, that violence has not been recognized, and prevention for that violence has not been prioritized in the workplace. And we know that that violence can be prevented.
And so there's a piece of legislation your group is supporting.
We had a huge victory yesterday, a really big win for nurses, for healthcare workers, for social service workers across the country. We passed H.R. 1309, the Workplace Violence Prevention for Healthcare and Social Service Workers Act. It's a bill that has been championed by Representative Joe Courtney from Connecticut, and we passed it in the House of Representatives yesterday with 251 yes votes in favor of the bill, including 32 Republican votes. It was a strong bipartisan majority that voted this piece of legislation through. This legislation would require OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to speed up passing a workplace violence prevention standard for healthcare and social service workers, which would require all of these employers to create these workplace violence prevention plans to monitor all violence in the workplace and to include the workers in the creation and implementation of these workplace violence prevention plans.
So where does it go now, to the Senate?
Yeah, so now it goes to the Senate. We do have a companion bill that was introduced some months ago in the Senate by Senator Tammy Baldwin, S-851. And so now that we passed it in the House, we'll turn our attention to the Senate to trying to move it forward in committee and then on the floor of the Senate.
You know, I thought Republicans were law and order. I thought all in the past, I don't think it would have had a problem. Why is there a problem in the Senate?
It has been the case politically this session in Congress that many bills that the House has passed just have not been taken up on the floor of the Senate. Many people refer to it as Mitch McConnell's graveyard. But we are hoping this bill should not be political. This is not a political issue. This is a bipartisan issue. It's about protecting these workers, because nurses, healthcare workers, social service workers, they should be safe when they're caring for us. And when they're safe, we are also protecting the safety of patients.
Wouldn't this possibly criminalize being a patient? Like, patients have enough problems now, they have to, if they overreact in a drug-induced state or out of surgery, they now could be charged with a criminal offense. Is that it?
No, this does not criminalize patients or further criminalize patients in any way. The focus of this bill and the focus of a standard instead would be and should be that employers are forced to develop plans in order to prevent the violence in the first place. And that's because, you know, the hospital is one of the most stressful places in society, right? There are many different complex factors that may lead to violence in the workplace. So this will force employers to look at developing systems that address environmental-specific risk factors and patient-specific risk factors. For example, when a nurse is in a hospital room with a patient, is there a line of sight for the nurse outside of the room so that if something happens, people can easily come in? How do we improve the security systems for nurses and other healthcare workers to immediately get help in hospitals? How do we improve systems so that if a patient has had an adverse reaction to a medication, the nurse coming, you know, a nurse starting a new shift, taking over care of that patient, knows about those adverse reactions, right? And most importantly, how do we ensure that the staffing levels for these healthcare workers are, the staffing levels are adequate so that when violent incidents occur, there is staff on hand to help defuse situations. So this is not about criminalizing patients. This is about preventing the violence in the first place.
The issue of staffing in hospitals and how hospitals are so understaffed, and that is sort of an underlying problem behind all of this.
Yes, that is absolutely an underlying problem. In hospitals across the country, we have nurses who they are so understaffed. There are numerous injuries and illnesses that happen in hospitals today because of unsafe staffing.
Amira Sakiera is lead legislative advocate for National Nurses United.
Doctors diagnose and physicians prescribe. Surgeons can operate, but they don't save your life. When the fever's burning, who helps you through the night? Gives you medication, checks your vital signs. When you wake up in recovery, who's right there by your side? With a smile and reassurance, restoring your self-pride. Thank the nurse, that's nursing you.
And this is the WBAI Evening News. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The New York State budget will be presented by the governor in January. Teachers and education organizations say schools need a lot more money. John Jagielski is chair of a coalition of six major pro-school groups asking the governor to increase the education budget by $2.1 billion, a 3% increase.
We're looking at $1.6 billion of it, primarily flowing through the foundation aid formulas to deal with current continuing current services. We've estimated what it would cost across the state to address the cost increases that would normally be part of increases for education. We then subtracted from that the amount of money that school districts could raise through the property tax. As you probably know, it's got a cap to it, and that cap is in the neighborhood of 3.7 or 1.7% this year.
I see. And you want to see that cap removed or increased?
Well, no, we've made proposals around. We know where it's not going to go away, but we've made proposals included in that paper to deal with some of the issues that we believe could strengthen and improve that.
There's a lot of resistance, which seems to me, I mean, just looking at it, in a lot of school boards, the voters don't want to increase their property taxes. That's always been sort of a problem with schools and
sure,
raising their
and
money.
And that's one of the reasons that the property tax cap was put in place. But think about it from this point of view. The funding for education comes from only primarily two sources. It comes from the local property taxes that are raised, and the state aid to schools. So if you're limiting the and they do limit the amount that can be raised by the local property tax, then it puts even more pressure on to maintain programs and services for students it really requires more money from the state. That's what the increase is for the 1.6 that I was talking about.
And that leads to, I assume that leads to higher taxes anyway, so you pay one or the other.
Not necessarily, because when was the last time you saw a tax increase at the state level?
I don't know. I haven't noticed.
No, there hasn't been. There hasn't been. And there's growth in the income of the state for a variety of reasons, because of economic conditions and what have you. But the school districts are in this squeeze, if you will, between getting funds from the state and getting funds from locally. And locally, that's now been driven down to a point where it is not a significant, certainly not significant enough to cover even the basic cost increases that happen from one year to another.
What's the other half billion? You mentioned 1.6, but 2.1, so there's half a billion.
Half a billion dollars. Those are funds to be targeted to assist schools in receivership, and more importantly, also to help deal with the increasing number of students with higher degrees of cost, of needs that cost more. And that a good example of that is we've had more and more students who have need to be taught English as a second language. To be able to succeed in schools is pretty difficult to not have that. So you certainly have to spend more and more money, and that's what schools have been doing to do that. That's also true in terms of the increases in the number of students who have special education needs. And those are generally more expensive needs to be addressed. That $500 million is for us. It targeted to those kinds of areas.
And that's John Jagielski. He's the chair of a coalition of six major pro-school groups asking the governor to increase the education budget by $2.1 billion. That would be a 3% increase. And that's some of the news for Friday, November 22nd, 2019. The news is produced with Linda Perry and Jesse Len. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios of listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.